Laveyer manifold appear as solutions to supersymmetry constraints. Today, I don't want to continue talking about Laveyer manifolds, so I would like to leave this for further reading, because what I would like to do is I would like to coordinate a little bit with your tutorial of today, which is about D-brain charges. So we would like to see more concretely how we can define D-brain charges, because I promised to talk a little bit about D-brain, so it's a huge subject, but I would like to cover at least the subject of D-brain charges. So D-brain charges. How can we define such charges? So how does a D-brain action look like? So let's talk a little bit about that. So what we had seen is that in string theory and M theory, there are different types of brains in the theory, or different types of tensor fields, let me first say, different types of tensor fields in the theory. And we had seen that a tensor field we can represent as an N-form, as a differential form, so a gauge field. So let me write this as AN. So a gauge field, which is a tensor field of rank n. So we can write it as 1 divided by n factorial. So I'm taking here factor mu 1 to mu n dx mu 1 wedge dx mu n. Then to this potential, so later on I'm going to summarize again one more time what type of potentials we saw in the different string theories. So we saw that in type 2a there's an axion, so there appears an axion, well, in the type 2a and type 2b. So there's the C0, the C2, different types of fields that we saw in the Ramon as well as Navier-Schwarz sector of the theory. So, and we are going to go through them in a little while. So, and what we had seen is that associated to this gauge field, we do have a field strength, so which is then, so if this is an N-form gauge field, this is an N plus 1 form gauge field, D of AN. And so that from here we can immediately see that the field strength is invariant under a transformation where the DA N, where this, so this one here shifts by a D of lambda, say an N-1 form. So because D square is equal to 0, so we see that this is invariant under a gauge transformation. And we had constructed several, so it's a gauge transformation, and we had constructed several field strength. We had seen that when we had a collection of field strength, we had constructed a collection of potentials. We had constructed particular types of field strength that come in the action, and these are the ones that are the gauge invariant field strength. So, so the question is, how can we define, number one, well, let me first say, why do these objects, these tensor fields, coupled to brains? So what do we mean with that? And number two, once we understand why this object coupled to brains, is how can we define the charge of a brain? So let me start with the really simple case, which is Maxwell's theory, and which is also the one you have been discussing in your tutorial. So we take D equal to 4, where we do have an U1 gauge field. So let's call it a mu. So what you have checked in your tutorial, in your homework, and it was very nicely shown there, so Callum wrote it down very nicely. What you have seen is that, number one, you can write the Maxwell's equation as df2 is equal to 0, and d of star F2 is equal to 0. So where, so remember that in your tutorial you saw that this F2 is a 4x4 matrix where in different entries you do have the electric and the magnetic field. So you can check that Maxwell's equation can be written in this manner. Well, let me define the star of F2 a little bit more detail, because we're going to need it in a moment in different type of dimensions, different types of brains, and so on. So let me show you what this star of F2 means concretely. So let me first write it out and then tell you. So what we see is that I do have a two form described by mu d minus 1 mu d, the two form which I multiply with the d-dimensional epsilon symbol. And what I see is that the dual form is then a d minus 2 form. So in other words, the dual of a two form in d dimensions, it's a d minus 2 form. And you can similarly generalize when you are dealing with p forms in d dimensions. So what I've done here is I wrote down the Maxwell's equations, but without charge. Without sources. But if we imagine that we do have sources, so and let me for the moment write down the Maxwell's equation in a symmetric way. Let me assume that there are electric and magnetic forces. So let's assume that there are magnetic monopoles. Then we can write down Maxwell's equations as d of star f2 equal to the electric current. So and d f2 equal to star of jm. So this is the magnetic current. So it's a four vector. And this is the electric current. So what I mean with that is, so if we write down J electric, it's a four vector that has components. So it's the electric charge or density. Let me put the density first. The density and the free vector J. So the current vector. So if we do have, as you also saw in the tutorial, it's kind of obvious that if you do have a point particle, so this rule for a point particle, simply so if you take an electric field, the charge density that I do have there, it's just a delta function. Okay, so far I haven't said anything fancy, just wrote down how the Maxwell's equations look like. And where does the point come in where I can define charge? So this E, this E here is the electric charge. And I'll call G, so G, the magnetic charge. The question is, so how can I define such charges? And the way we can define such charges, well, we can define them in the same way as we define charges in physics 101 through the electric flux. So what we know, what we teach our students in physics 101 is that if you take the electric flux, if I do have a point particle or any other charged object, so what I know is that what I can do is I can surround, this point particle with a sphere. And what we know is that the electric flux, so let me call this phi e, through the sphere is proportional, it's equal to the enclosed charge. So let me call this q enclosed, which is nothing but Gauss's law. If you want to kind of see what it means, suppose we do have, so it's for an arbitrary charge configuration, but suppose we do have a point charge Q, so where we know that the electric field, so just to check that we understand what we're doing here, so we know that the electric field is the, let me put this this way, and let me put epsilon 0, so Coulomb's constant equal to 1. So what we know is that the electric field takes this form here. So then we can easily compute from there the flux. So what we know is that the electric flux is equal to R times dA, so which is, I don't need a dA in this case. because it's a constant. So what we know is that there's a unit vector. Let me call this A. The area, so the area of the sphere is 4 pi times r squared. And E points also in the radial direction. So let me put an ER here. So what I know is that the electric flux in this case is what? The electric field, which is the 4 pi Q divided by r squared, multiplied by the area of the sphere, which is the 4 pi r squared. So what I see is I get from here, so the electric charge, so just in the simple example, which we teach in physics 101. So from there we see that charge of a point particle follows from Gauss's law. Any charge object, you can always show that you get the charge by taking a sphere or whatever Gaussian surface you would like to take around. So what I see is, so electric flux gives me the charge of this point particle. And so what you have checked, so which was very convenient in your homework, is I could write down, so the electric charge that I just wrote down here. So well, let me just write it down in this way one more time. So in general, E times dA is Q enclosed. And what you have very conveniently checked in your tutorial is that you can write this electric flux precisely as the integral over a two-sphere star of F2, which according to what we just discussed is the electric charge. And we can, so the same thing we can do for the magnetic charge. So we can compute the magnetic flux, which is the so integral of B times dA. So and what we can then get from there is the magnetic charge, so which is the integral of the two form over S2, which is the magnetic charge. So that's how, in the case of Maxwell's theory, we can define the charges. And so there is one observation which then later on generalizes to p-brains as well, p-brains and d-brains, so which is Dirac's quantization condition. So so there's a Dirac quantization condition which tells us that the product of E times G is 2 pi times an integer. And so let's think how Dirac derived such a quantization condition in 1931. And his argument was as follows. So suppose you do have an electron moving in the field. So suppose you do have an electron moving in the field of a magnetic monopole. So let's put here a magnetic monopole and an electron that moves around. So what we can do is to look at the wave function. So suppose this electron moves from one point x0 to a point x prime. Then in a very similar way as we discussed yesterday when we were discussing how the holonomy looks like when we move, when we do have a spinner, we saw that there's a holonomy when we rotate the spinner, which is described, which means the spinner after a rotation doesn't come by itself back to itself. So that's what we discussed yesterday. So the spinner doesn't come back to itself, but it comes back to a spinner that is the product of U times psi, where we called U the holonomy of the manifold. This U, in the case where we were discussing spinners and gravity, the holonomy was given by an exponential of the spin connection, of the integral over the spin connection. Let me put here mu, maybe mu. And we said that the spin connection plays the role of the gauge field for local Lorentz transformations. So the same thing is the case here. So the holonomy in this case, so if you look at how the wave function, ordinary quantum mechanics, the wave function, so let's look at a simpler case. In ordinary quantum mechanics, so when you look at how you couple an electron in an electromagnetic field, and you know that the way you describe such a system, well, you have this vector potential, you have got the minimal coupling, this ensures gauge invariance, and you know that the wave function in that case transforms again. So that's psi is now the wave function. It's not the spinner of yesterday. Wave function. So what we know is that the wave function transforms as transforms again as u times psi, where this u, which is the holonomy again, so it's also called the holonomy, it's the exponential of I times the integral of a, let me again put a, dx mu here. Well, or let me write it down a little bit more precisely. So it's, you can write this as the pullback. So if the particle moves, I said, from a point x0 to a point x prime. So that is how the wave function, so this is again the holonomy, which tells us how the wave function changes when the electron moves from a point x0 to a point x prime. Or let me write this as the pullback on the line, on the trajectory of the electron. So we can write this as the pullback, which is the expression that is going to be, so writing down the expression in this way, it's going to be useful later on when we look at the Higer generalization. So once we know how the holonomy looks like, so how the wave function changes, so what we can do is let's take a look at a path, at a closed path. Let me paint it first. So let's take a look. So suppose we do have the monopole sitting here. And let me, let's have the electron move around a closed trajectory around that monopole. So let me call this gamma. So what I know is that in this case, for this closed path, so we can write again that this is e to the I integral around the closed path gamma a mu dx mu. However, what we can do, since we know that this a mu is df, so we know that a, so that f is equal to dA. So what we can do is we can express the holonomy in terms of our surface integral. So again by Stokes, that this tells us that this line integral of a dx, we can express this as a surface integral over a disk. So I'll tell you in a second what the disk is, of F2. So this disk D is a disk that has boundary equal to gamma. So what I know is I can now choose. So this is just nothing but Stokes. So what it means is I can now choose a different, I can choose a disk, say this one here, and integrate over this disk. So let me call this disk D. But in principle, I could also go ahead. Let me call this D. In principle, nobody told me that this disk is unique. I could, in principle, have integrated also over this disk here, which has also the same boundary. So the blue line is also the boundary of this disk here. And let me call this D prime. So what I know is, and in both cases, it's the boundary. So the boundary is equal to gamma. So and what I know is that the difference, so the integration is the same result. But what I know is that the difference, d minus d prime, is a two-sphere. So what I know is that if I integrate over this object here, and this one, they differ by a sign. And what I know is that then if I carry the entire integration, it's an integration over a two-sphere. So what I know is that if I take I can integrate F2 over D. I can integrate F2 over D prime, which is equivalent to, it's topologically equivalent to integrating F2 over a two-sphere. However, if I integrate F2 over a two-sphere, so I arrest it now, but what we had seen is that this is precisely the definition of the magnetic charge. It's precisely the definition of the magnetic charge. In other words, that if I look at my holonomy, and I forgot one crucial thing in the holonomy, which is the E in front of here. So that one I should have made sure that it's there. So there's the electric charge there. So what I see is that in the holonomy, so I do have an exponential of I multiplied by the electric charge multiplied by the magnetic charge, which came from integrating the F2 over S2. And we know that if we would like to have a wave function that is well defined, so what we would like to have is that this object here is 2 pi times an integer. So that the wave function, once we rotate, so once the electron comes back, the wave function comes back to itself. So that's a simple way, yes?
Why is that equal to zero?
Why is that
not
equal to zero?
Because the thing is integration.
Because they differ by a sign. It's the different orientation. It gives a different sign.
But it's still zero. We use the any digs, any closed digs.
We use.
Surface, so why are they not equal if I use D1 and D2?
Because they are the same. So this one, integration over this one differs by the integration of this one by a sign. And I'm putting them in such a way together that's integration over a sphere. Well, if you don't, so if in your mind this one cancels out, then let me put a plus sign. I don't care which one you want to put but I'm going to put it in such a way that the entire integration is the integration over a two-sphere. So what I have is, so that's what we've seen also, that is Dirac quantization condition for a point like object. Well, if you want to kind of say it in a fancy way, for a zero brain, which is a point like object. And what we're going to see, or the same statement, let me say it that way. So the same statement holds for brains and the magnetic dual. So there's a, so let me see if I wrote it down. Probably I didn't go through the, yes, I did. So what we have is same statement applies for brains, but I didn't, I don't want to go through the derivation. So the same statement holds for brains. And I still haven't told you what the charge of a brain is, so let me just for now write down the statement. So if I do have a P brain, so the charge of a P brain, let me call this mu P, times mu 6 minus P is going to be 2 pi times an integer. So this is a statement that holds for P brains. A brain and the dual, so the it's again a brain charge and the charge of the dual brain. And I, as I say, I still haven't even defined what I mean. Brain charge. And dual brain charge, or charge of the dual brain, better. Satisfy Dirac quantization condition. I'm going to tell you in a moment what we mean with charge of a brain. And so to show how the Dirac quantization works, so I wrote down, so it's an exercise 6.4 in our book. So, but let me first, so so you can, if you would like to see how such statements can generalize, so try to solve this exercise. And we have, I think we have the solution in the book. So, but let me first show you what is what I mean when I talk about charges of a brain. So the Heigner generalization to prevalence goes as follows. So what we know is what prevalent charges what we had seen is that if we are in four dimensions and we do have a zero brain, a point particle, then we can define the electric charge E as the integral of star F2 over an S2 over a 2 sphere. And in general, and let me make the statements first, and then we can think why this is so. So the generalization of this, if we do have a point particle in D dimensions, so the question is, what are we going to integrate it over? So suppose we do have a point particle in D dimensions. So in this case, so here we can say that we can surround a point particle. So the way we can also express this is that we can surround a point particle by a 2 sphere. So in D equal to 4, we can surround a particle of a point particle with a 2 sphere. A 2 sphere surrounds a point particle. Let me put the zero brain. So, and the way we can generalize this, suppose we do have a zero brain in D dimensions, then it's a D, so a point particle in D dimensions is surrounded by a D minus 2 sphere. Let's go, in a moment, why that is so, it's a counting, so it's a slow counting of what is the charge, so what does the brain couple to, what is the corresponding charge, which involves taking the dual, and then when you do have the dimension, so the type of form you have, you get the type of sphere. But let me hold it for a second. So in principle, as an example, so what it means is that if you do have a zero brain, in type 2A3, so we can surround the D0 brain by an S8, by an 8 sphere. And let me, so before I continue with the next statement, let me show you how we can see this. So it's again a moment of focusing which brain couples to what. And if you do too many times, you get at the end again confused. But let me show you so how we can see this. So what we know is that if we do have an F2, we know that it's a, so F2, well, let me put an F2 with an index 2 here. So we know that F2, which is a D of C1, we know that this couples to a D0 brain. And now we can go from here. So we know that if you do have an F3, it's a D1. An F4 is a D2. F2, 3, 4, 5, F5, F6, F7, F8. So this is a D2. D3, D4, D5, D6.
Question?
Yes?
Sorry. Does D up in number 1, does that mean the number of
spaces? Oh, no. I'm just counting the type of brain. D0 brain, D1, D2. I was going to explain. So what it means is if I do have a D0 brain, it couples to a C1.
And on that other word, so the point particle in D dimensions is surrounded.
It's a point. Yeah. This is the D dimensions, yes.
So,
and I was going to, so let's check it.
Okay.
I'm going to check it, so let's
I guess the question that we're having is, if you imagine a plane and you have a point on the plane, you only need a one sphere to encircle a point on a plane, and you need a two sphere to encircle a point in three dimensions.
Okay, so now comes
so
the mystery.
So it's d minus one or d minus two in those
space
cases.
Space, time, not space.
What?
D space, time, dimensions.
The Pibrian is d plus one dimensional.
So your statement on the board there is that you, when you're saying d dimensions, you mean space, time, dimensions.
D space, time, dimensions. Yes. Ooh, okay. D space, time, dimensions. So let's check for a second. So what I have is type of brain. I know that so this is the D of C2. So let's check, for example, the statement that I made here. The zero in type 2A is surrounded by an S8. So what I know is that the D zero brain is a C1. I know that the C1 is so the field strength corresponding to C1 is an F2. The charge is the dual of F2. Which is an F8, and I integrate an F8 over an 8 sphere, which explains why. So the D0 brain is surrounded by an S8. So, and similarly, so then there's the next statement. So D0 brain in type 2A is surrounded by an S8. The next statement is that if I do have a. So indeed, I mentioned, so here comes the next statement. And again, we can check the statement. So it's a matter of kind of sitting down and thinking for a moment. So indeed, I mentioned these spacetime dimensions. A two sphere. Surrounds a D minus four brain. So let's look at an example. So if I plug in here, say a D six brain in D equal to 10, so D six brain in D equal to 10 is surrounded by minus two. So now it's again, so if you look at so the D6 brain, so what we know is that the D6 brain couples to a DC, so to the C7. I'm going to explain more slowly what the coupling again means. So there's a Chin Simons term there that I'm going to describe for you a little bit later. So what it means when I say D6 brain couples to something, we're going to see. So but what I see is that on the wall volume of the D6 brain, there's a field C7. Field strength is F8, so the charge is the dual of F8, which means that I do have a two form that I need to integrate over a two sphere. So that's the statements. And we are going to need this when we would like then to define the charges. So what we have, and maybe I should have written this down here, so and we are going to see this. So on the world volumes, were very similar as we had for the case of the point particle. In the case of brains, and I'm going to explain this in much more detail in a little while. So there is a Chen Simons term on the world volume of a brain, which is of the form mu p multiplied by integral. Or let me be a little bit more precise here. Let me erase you. So on the world volume of a brain, there is a Chen Simons term. Let me call it S. So it's a part of the world volume action of the brain that takes the form mu p integral a p plus 1 for a p brain. So, well, a dp brain. Let me call this so that's a dp brain. And where this a p plus 1, it's again. So which is why the other one I wanted to write as a pullback. So this, so very crisp. Well, let me put it here because. So it's simply the pullback of the form onto the brain Borg volume. So So in straightforward analogy, what we had for the point-like case, so the AP plus 1, so the integral of AP plus 1 that I wrote down there simply means the pullback of the form on the wall volume of the brain. And the way we can define, so in again, so in analogy to what we had before, so we can define the electric charge, of the brain in terms of the electric flux, which is so the generalization to what we had for the fine particle. So we can define the electric flux, which is why we needed to think, so what couples to what, so which form couples to which brain, and what is what I'm integrating it over. So the electric flux for RP brain, the electric charge for RP brain, we can define in terms of the electric flux, which in straightforward analogy to what we had for the point particle is takes this from here. So again, so this is the electric flux of our brain. So electric flux of our brain, you can figure out so it's electric flux of our P brain. So this is our P brain charge. So our P brain is P plus one dimensional. So now you have to figure out what the potential is that couples to a P plus one dimensional extended object, which, well, I set it here. So it's this one here. So then we do have a field strength that is P plus two dimensional. Okay, we can see it from here. So I do have an A, P plus one dimensional object living on the brain, on a P brain, which means that I do have a field strength F P plus two. And the charge is the dual of this, the flux is the dual of the field strength, the electric flux, which gives me the electric charge. So from there we see how we can define, so this is the electric charge. So electric charge of a P brain. And again, in straightforward analogy to what we had for the point particle case, we can define the magnetic charge, so the magnetic dual charge. Or the charge of a dual brain. So what we know is that, so if you do have, two brain. So if you you know that you do have in 10 dimensions, you do have zero brains, say in the type 2A theory, then we know that there's a corresponding dual brain, which is the eight brain, which in this case, so the magnetic charge, which is the magnetic charge of that brain is then, or in more general case now, D minus P minus 4, which is an S P plus 1, not P plus 2. So that is the magnetic charge in analogy to what we had in the point particle case. And again, so it's straightforward generalization. Just figure out, so what form lives on what brain? So what is the field strength? What is the dual? And what is the dimension of the brain? And as I say, so once I've defined now electric and magnetic charges, so you can check that this object again so satisfy Dirac quantization condition. And the derivation goes in a rather similar way as we have done for the point particle. So now that we understand, what is what we mean with electric and magnetic charges of brains. So let me let's make again a table, because what the existence of, so the fact that electric charge is conserved, it's going to be telling us what the type of stable D brains in the type 2 theories are. So if we are in, charges of brains guarantee stability. So charge conservation, let me say it that way, charge conservation guarantees stability. Stability of brains. So what we know is, so we can figure out, so what we know that in the Ramon-Ramon forms that we do have in the type 2A theory. So if you look, so we worked out very carefully the dimensional reduction of the type 2A theory. So what we know is that if you look at the Ramon-Ramon forms of the type 2A theory, so we had an A1, so I'm writing down the gauge fields. So these are gauge fields, not the potentials. These are the gauge fields that we got in type 2A theory. So recall, this was the gauge field, if you remember, that comes from the 11-dimensional metric. So the off-diagonal components of the 11-dimensional metric, there was a gauge field A3, which comes from the 3 form. Then there are the corresponding dual fields, A5 and A7. So, and these fields, according to the Chern-Simons formula that I now erased, coupled to a D0 brain, to a D2 brain, to a D4 brain, and a D6 brain. In the type 2B theory, so if you look at the Ramon-Ramon sector in the type 2B theory, it's in the other way around. So what we have is an A0, an A2, an A4, and an A6, which couple to, so this one couples to, A1 couples to D0, so A0 couples to what? It's an instanton. So this one you can only make sense in the Euclidean theory, so let's forget about this one. So if you consider the Minkowski theory, let's take just the other ones. So this couples to a D1 brain, which is the D string. This one couples to a D5 brain. And this one couples to the 7 brain. So in this way, we can, through a charge, Ramon-Ramon charge conservation, argue what are the type of charge, the type of brains, stable D brains that we do have in type 2 theories. So let me, if there are no questions on this, unless there are there any questions?
Can you have a dual for the A0?
Can I have?
A dual for the A0.
A dual. So
what we dual, so the A6 is dual for the A2.
Yes.
So what's dual for the A0? Can we not have?
Okay, A0 is F. Wait, so A0 is D, it's an F1. Oh, it's an...
An A dual to a D9. Can you have that?
D9 brain is something that fits out the entire specimen. So
I was wondering why you didn't include it on your chart.
Oh. Oh, well, you could have in principle, you're right. So in principle, you could have had a D9 brain. D9 brain fits out the entire space-time. You could have had a D8 brain here as well. You are so right. I should have done that. So I do have an A7, an A9, an A8. So these are the duals. Did I miss anything else? No, I think I filled out all the dimensions. So this one fills out all 10-dimensional space-time. So so once we know what type of brains we have, so let me show you why I was, so what it means that a particular type of gauge field couples to a particular type of brains, because for my arguments to derive the charges, I use the Chern-Simons term for a D-brain. So let me show you then how the world volume action of a D-brain looks like. And the word volume action of a D-ring, you had again in one of the tutorials, a very nice exercise, which described the action for a D0 brain. And probably Katrin also discussed it in her lecture, how the action for a D0 brain looks like. So what is relevant now is the Green-Schwarz formalism. And so word volume actions for D-brains. So again, so a D brain is a D, so a D phi brain. It's a P plus one dimensional extended object. So a D brain, so as we kind of learned when we open a string theory book, so a D brain. So if you do have an open string, the ends of an open string end on a hyperplane. This hyperplane is called a D-brain. But that D-brain is actually a dynamical object. So they are massless fields. So the massless fields of the open string live on the wall volume of the brain, which means that if we are at very low energies, we take just the massless fields of the brain into account, and we can construct a field theory, a P plus one dimensional field theory on which the massless fields live. So a D brain, so the world volume action of a DP brain, so it's a P plus one dimensional field theory. And again, so if we are in the low energy limit, so it will include the massless fields of the open string. The action for the P brain is again taking into account the Green-Schwarz formalism. So such an action can be obtained if you look at the Green-Schwarz formalism. So what is what we remember from the Green-Schwarz formalism? So what we know is that we had an action, so which took the form of a number Gödel type action, where we do have coordinates x mu of our 10-dimensional spacetime that describes in general the embedding of the string, or in general the higher dimensional brain into spacetime. We know that we had spinners, theta, so theta a. So I'm just writing down what we know also. So take a look at the zero brain. So we know these are the ingredients of the action. And then the new ingredient, so the new ingredient that comes for the case of our D-brain is that on the whole volume of the D-brain there is a gauge field, a U1 gauge field. So let me call this a mu. So let me take for now one single brain, so that I do have an U1 gauge field. In general, it's going to be something non-abelian. But let me take the simpler case for now and consider number one a brain, a single D brain, and let me take for a moment a D brain in flat space, in flat 10-dimensional space. So D brain in flat space, and I'm going to show you how the D brain in flat space generalizes later. So D brain in flat space, and let me put a one here. So we are going to consider just one D brain because I would like to consider an abelian U1 gauge field. So one. So the world volume action for such a brain takes the following form, and you will recognize this from the, so it's called the DBI action. So, but you will recognize it more from the Namugota action of the string. So it's a generalization of what you had seen in the first week, which probably Federica Schatzer told you about it, the Namugota action of a string. So it's called a DBI action, which is Dirac Borean theft. But as I say, it reminds more of the Namugoto, so Namugoto should, in principle, also be somewhere in the name. So it's an action that takes following form. So there's the, so this T, DP, that I'm writing down is called the tension of the brain. It's an integral over a T plus one dimensional wall volume, square root of minus determinant of G alpha beta plus, tell you in a second what the quantities are that I'm writing down. So the quantities that I'm writing down, so you will record, so this K, first of all, it's just a constant, 2 pi alpha prime. And you will recognize, so the Namugoto action, once I tell you that the G alpha beta, so the, let me put it here, so the G alpha beta, or compare this maybe with the point particles, so it's, I'm taking flat 10-dimensional space-time, P alpha mu, P beta mu, where the pi that I wrote down is, so this, so that's simply a pullback. Let me write it down over here. So the quantity pi we had introduced for the, we had introduced this notation already for the D0 brain. So let's, let me remind you this pi. And I'm taking the supersymmetric case. So the pi is going to involve the fields x mu and the fields theta. And the f that I introduced here, the Curie f, is simply related to the f that is dA. So this f is, put this in this way. So this is simply the dA. Oh, let me put this back ahead. So this is simply dA. And then there is a second part, B alpha theta, so this here involves fermions. So let me not write down how this object here looks like, the B. So it's a function of theta that you can find in the book. So let me for now just say, so the F contains the U1 gauge field. So so what you see is, so that's the action, how part of the action of the D brain looks like. So this part of the action involves the tension of the D brain. So that, but if in straightforward analogy to what we have for a point particle, so we know that this is not the entire part of the action. We know that there's one additional part of the action, which is the Chern-Simons term, which guarantees the kappa symmetry. So it's, so the, and that's the one that give us, that will give us the tension of the brain. So there's one more, so there's, so the Ramon-Ramon field, so, oh, maybe before I get ahead of myself, before I get to the Chern-Simons term, let me hold on for a second. And let me show you how the formula that I wrote down, this formula there, looks number one in a fixed gauge. In a fixed gauge, because that's the form of the action that I can tell you later on for a general background. So if you take, so, if you take a particular gauge, which is called the static gauge, where what we do is we identify some of the x mu coordinates with the world volume coordinates. So just take this just as a gauge fixing. So, and we take p plus 1 of them in this way, because we do have p plus 1 world volume coordinates. So p plus 1 coordinates, we are going to gauge fix. And the remaining coordinates, so all the other coordinates, I'm going to call phi. So let me call this phi I are the remaining coordinates. So the remaining x mu's. So and when I fix the sketch, the action, so in this sketch, the action, because that's the form of the action I can give you then in a general background. So the gauge fixed action in flat space takes the following form. So that's the dBi action in flat space. Again, the tangent of the brain, b p plus 1, sigma square root of minus determinant. G alpha beta plus K square so these are the fields X, the remaining fields X which I call phi I, and then there's one additional term that comes from the gauge field. So that is the dBi action in flat space. And if we, so very similarly as we, so when we were talking the other day about the sigma model action for a string, I wrote down the sigma model action, I wrote down the term containing the metric, and then I wrote down a term containing, so for the bosonic string, I wrote down the a term containing a tachyon, a two-form field strength, so the two-form field B2 of the type B3 and the dilaton term. And then people were asking, so why, just a second, why did you include those in the action of the string? And then one of you said, well, that's just a background field, which was exactly right. So the same thing we're going to do in this case. So if you write down the dBrain for a general background, then we will get a dilaton, so we get the background fields, we'll get a dilaton, we will get a general metric, and we will get a two-form field strength, which I'm going to write down in a second. You had a question? Round alpha. That's what you mean? Oh. Okay, good. It's a determinant, right. Thank you. So for the general case, if you do have a dBrain in a general background, so what you get is, so we get a dilaton. So we have a, so dilaton, we do have a general metric, so G alpha beta. We do have the two-form field, B alpha beta, up here in the action. So the form of the action in a general background, let me write it down over here. So the dBi part of the action contains only the Navier-Schwarz fields of the theory. So say of type 2 theories. So you will recognize the fields that I just wrote down here. So these are the fields in the NS sector, so Navier-Schwarz sector of type 2. So and these are the ones that appear in the dBi action. So the form of the dBi action. And again, so I'm not deriving the action. I'm just telling you how the result of the action looks like. So here's a coupling to the dilaton. Then there's again the term with the determinant. So here there's the two-form, the B field of type 2 theories. We use now. The two-form of type 2B, of type 2 theories, type 2A or type 2B. And then I do have my fields phi, which describe. So these are the x's, so the remaining x's, which you can view if you would like to ask the position of the brain. I describe brain positions, the scalars that I do up here, plus k times f alpha beta. So that's a D brain in general, in a general background. And again, so this is the tangent of the D brain. So it's the tangent of the D brain. And so the last thing that I need to tell you about the world volume action of a D brain. So I told you now how the fields that are the massless fields in the Navier-Schwarz sector appear on the world volume of a D brain. So the last thing that I need to tell you is how the Ramon-Ramon sector fields appear. So the forms that we do have in the Ramon sector, so from the Ramon-Ramon sector. We get a contribution to the brain, which is the Chern-Simons term I was telling you about. And again, so recall that in the case of a D0 brain, you had a similar Chern-Simons term. It's the one that guarantees kappa symmetry and plus supersymmetry. So if this thing is not there, you don't have a supersymmetric action. So this guarantees, so it's kappa symmetry. And the form of the Chern-Simons action is this mu p times integral cp plus 1. Again, it means the pullback of the form onto the brain volt volume. This mu p here, it's another constant, which is the charge of the brain. And it's the one so I use then to define carefully so what a p brain charge is. So that's the charge of the brain. And so that explains why I was using, so when I was deriving, so what is the general expression for the electric and magnetic charge of our brain? So why I was using such a coupling? Yes?
I'm confused about the presence or absence of B alpha beta because of, like, is it two different actions? Because you wrote this exact same action without the B alpha beta.
Yes.
And the one with B alpha beta. So what happened?
I kicked out the dilaton and I kicked out, so this is the action for a general background. The action I took before was for a flat background where I kicked out the dilaton and I kicked out the B field by hand.
Okay.
I took them out by hand, and this is the action in general, where I can have in general a dilaton, I can have an arbitrary metric, and I can have a B field. So the other one was just a special case. Yes.
On that left order, what happened when you had, so you were doing it on a flat background there, and that's what that E to mu nu is.
Yeah.
So then you're going to have a B field as well. You also have a B. So you have a, when the E to mu nu is, you could give the space time metric big G.
Yes.
But you also have the B mu nu.
I also have the B mu nu in.
Well,
you
also have those B field as a background field.
Yes.
Would you put it in with your big G alpha beta in the same place that the eta is? Is that where it appears?
So wait, what do you want to do?
Where would the B field appear on the left board?
Where would the B field be on the left board? So what you do is you write down, so I didn't write a B field here. So what you do, if you do have a B field, you replace this G alpha beta by G alpha beta plus B alpha beta.
Okay, so it doesn't come into the, so your eta alpha beta enters somewhere in the G.
Eta alpha beta enters in the G, in the space-time metric.
But you don't need to pull the, how do you pull back the B
alpha,
B
mu? Oh, okay.
Well,
I would put the same thing, but the point is I didn't put a B field here. But you would do the same, well, you could pull it back in the same way. So I write down a B. Oh, I see what you're saying.
You get a B alpha beta equals B mu nu pi something pi.
Give me just a second. Yeah, you're right. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's what, so. General formula is G alpha beta plus B alpha beta is G mu plus B mu, but as I say, I kicked out the B mu for the flat background, B alpha times mu. I'm not taking Fermions now, so let me just take the Fermions for now. So that's the way how you pull back. So there's just one last thing that I would like to mention. which is what we see from looking at the world volume action of the steel grain. So if you recall that the dilaton was related to e to the phi was related to the dilaton, to the expectation value of the dilaton. So what you see is that the tangent of a D brain is an object that goes with 1 over GS. So from the world volume action of this brain, what I see is I do have a tangent, so I can pull this factor, so I can pull the factor e to the minus phi out. So it's the expectation value of the dilaton. I could pull this out, and I have what I can see from there. So the fact that I do have a factor e to the minus phi here, it's an indication that for a D brain, so let me write down tangent, let me put this in this way, T is equal to TP divided by GS. In other words, the tangent of a D brain, so this is for a DP brain, so for a D brain, it's a tangent that goes with 1 divided by the string coupling constant. If you look at an ordinary brain, so say the Nevel-Schwarz, the 5 brain in the Nevel-Schwarz 5 frame of the type 2A theory, so something that doesn't couple to a Ramon-Ramon field strength, but to a Nevel-Schwarz field strength. So for an ordinary P brain, so which is what I mean by an ordinary P brain. So what you can show, what you can see, if you look at it carefully, that the tangent of such a brain is something that is proportional to 1 divided by GS squared. So as opposed to D brains, so D brains go with 1 over GS, brains that don't carry Ramon-Ramon charge, the tangent goes with 1 divided by GS squared. And the point of why people say you can use D brains to study string geometry is that if you look at the minus 1 over GS and compare it to 1 divided by GS squared, when GS goes to 0, the effect of this one, so this tangent, becomes much larger. So for GS string equal to 0, so in the weak coupling limit, so for GS going to 0, the tangent of this brain here, so this T becomes very large, much larger than the one that goes with 1 over GS, so it becomes very large. And it becomes so large, the tangent of such a brain, that if you do have a brain in your space-time with a tangent that goes like this, then if you go to the weak coupling limit, then the effect of the brain is going to be have a hard back reaction on your background, which means it's going to destroy your background, and you cannot study. So what effect does this brain have on the background? While here you can the 1 over GS doesn't have such a strong effect. And you can still study your background in the weak coupling limit. So which is why people say you can use D brains to explore string geometry. So explore string geometry. Because you can, in the presence of a D brain, you can still study in the weak coupling limit, you can still study your background. So this is so far what I wanted. Let me see if I forgot you something. So this is, I think, all I wanted to tell you about D brains. So I think I'm going to be stopping here, and it's the end of our course. So, and I enjoyed teaching for you guys, and I hope to see some of you becoming famous string theorists at some point.